want the Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your host is humbled by the voluntary support of many great Americans. Let's name names. David Polson, Lee Ann Rayer, Christopher Welsh, Mary Gruber. If you'd like to help and you're financially able, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. Our voluntary subscriptions start as low as $5 a month. On today's podcast, we take a trip to the Midwest. First to Ohio, the place where I was born, and then to Michigan, the two states most devastated by the loss of manufacturing jobs. But my city was gone. And the recession driven by corporate greed.
There was no train station. There was no downtown. So tired it disappeared.
Our correspondent in Michigan is Ray Boersma, and he'll join us shortly. Also, before the end of this podcast, we have a great new movie review from Gary Chu. Way to go, Ohio. And contrary to some public popular belief, Rush Limbaugh does not own the rights to that music. Chrissy Hynde does. The Pretenders wrote it and released it back in the 1980s. And I think Rush Limbaugh is oblivious to the lyrics of the song and what it is actually about. Well, to learn more about what's going on in the corporate-led, radical Republican legislative onslaught that started in Wisconsin, that's where most people noticed it first, but the virus has spread very quickly, and Ohio and Michigan are two states where it has taken the most extreme forms. Our correspondent on the ground in the capital, Columbus, Ohio, where the O is optional, is Cliff Schechter. And he single-handedly rescued us from the scourge of John McCain by publishing the book The Real McCain back in 2007-2008. He is a blogger, he's a political activist, and he spent some time working for the state treasurer of Ohio. Cliff, welcome back to our program.
Thanks, Peter. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I'm not in Ohio anymore.
Well, I am, but I'm doing okay, too, although giving me single-handed credit on McCain is very kind of you, but I like to think that he helped us a lot along the way.
Well, he certainly did, and Ohio contributed Joe the Plumber to the cause as well. So
that's true. In parts of Ohio and the whole country, you know, we can even way up in Alaska, there's someone we can thank for helping sink John McCain. So,
indeed, yeah. Well, maybe I was overstating it a little bit, but I do appreciate the work you did. And your book was temporarily shelved because it looked like McCain wasn't going to be the Republican nominee.
Now, that was a fun period of time, as you can imagine. I'd put about 9 months or so into research and writing the vast majority of the book, and then McCain looked like he was going to be going to almost at times come in third or fourth, and so it got shelved for a while. And then, thanks to the wonderful work of Mitt Romney, Rudy Giuliani, and others, Fred Thompson, among others, who found ways to lose primaries in hugely interesting ways, which I did. I thanked them in my book at the end, because if they hadn't all been such terrible candidates, McCain probably never would have come back.
Well, and of those, Fred Thompson is the only one, well, just about the only one who hasn't taken a paid position on Fox News Channel.
That's a good point, but I think he's probably got paid positions God knows how many other places. So,
right, yeah, he's a shill. He is.
So, but in any case, yeah, it was fun. I mean, I had to cram for about a month to write the final few chapters when we got it out, and look, it hit a bestseller list. So what are you going to, you know, I have no complaints.
Well, good. Well, Cliff, I wanted to turn to you to get the details on the specifics of how Ohio is implementing the national Republican mandate. One of the downsides of the Republican sweep in the 2010 midterm elections is that they claimed governorships and expanded or built new Republican majorities in legislatures, particularly across the middle of the country. And they're really ramming through legislation. They are working very quickly. There is a national blueprint for this. We'll talk about ALEC a little bit later. But tell us about the details of Senate Bill 5, championed by your new governor, John Kasich, who many people remember from his role in the Bush administration.
That's right. He was a congressman way back when, and he's been around for a while. Let me start by saying, it was troubling for me, like everybody, what happened election night. I think even more so, in some cases for me, you mentioned I worked for the state treasurer. I also worked in 2008. One of the first things I did after moving to Ohio was working as a spokesperson and strategist on the effort to take back the state house, which the Republicans had had since that last terrible year of 1994. And we were able to take back the state house at about midnight election night and ended up winning, about 7 seats, as I remember. We needed about 4, and it was a terrific night. And so, it looked like, who knows, the Republicans had the state Senate, but Democrats had most of everything else here. But what I would say is a combination of timidity in Washington and from Democrats, particularly those at 1600 Pennsylvania, with some blue dog Democrats here in Ohio, also sadly, who ceded too much ground on too many issues. And then the Republicans grew more radical than ever, and when the economy didn't improve, this is what we got. And to get to your specific point, with Senate Bill 5, it's worse than Wisconsin's, actually, which I think a lot of people don't know, because that one, if I'm correct, and I think I am, didn't include corrections officers and state troopers and firefighters, whereas the one here does. So their collective bargaining, we're talking about thousands of workers employed by the state and state agencies, have those rights taken away. Even those working for counties and cities, they still have collective bargaining rights, but they've been very much watered down and tilted in favor of management.
And to your point, Cliff, the New York Times ran a piece last week comparing Wisconsin's legislations with Ohio's and did declare that Ohio's is more draconian.
No doubt, health benefits are no longer even allowed to be a subject of negotiations. Public employers are not allowed to pay more than 80%. And, again, I was a public employee at one time, and even at that level, health insurance is pretty darn expensive these days, as we all know. And so those are some of the things it does. I'm trying to think of some of the other ones. It particularly targets teachers. Obviously, teachers can be laid off in all sorts of scenarios. Public employers can manipulate state fiscal emergency laws to reopen labor contracts unilaterally. There's a lot of bad provisions in there, let's put it that way.
And Cliff, did Kasich do similar to Walker's playbook where he created the crisis by first cutting taxes for business or wealthy individuals?
Well, we had the crisis here already because of that. Mm-hmm. So Kasich refused. He wasn't going to raise taxes on anybody. The problem is, and this is where some of my criticism might come in of Blue Dog Democrats too, is that we'd had a tax cut put in place 2 governors ago by Bob Taft, of the many, the long line of Tafts. We can go back, it seems like centuries almost, and there's a Taft always somewhere.
Well, and they came out of Cincinnati. We often refer to them as the Shafts because that's what they delivered to the public, going back to Senator Taft, Sr., who was the Taft in the Taft-Hartley Act, which
that's
was
right.
One of the first attacks on union organizing and the effort to set up so-called right-to-work states.
Right, and before him, of course, we have William Howard Taft,
right.
Who, because of his shilling for corporations, his former protege, Teddy Roosevelt, broke with him and ended up, in the end, really largely by taking 27% of the vote as a bull moose, ended up throwing him out of office and putting Woodrow Wilson in. Of course, we later got stuck with William Howard Taft as a Supreme Court justice. So
right.
It didn't turn out so terrifically, depending on him. But you can go to a museum in Cincinnati where they've got the bathtub where he once got stuck in because he weighed over 300 pounds.
That's true. That's true. I've seen it.
So there's a little nice side note. But in any case, to get back to the main point, so Taft passed this bill, you know, for to cut taxes mostly on the top 1%. What's new? And Governor, you know, Governor Ted Strickland, who in some ways was progressive, certainly on environmental issues and others, but on other issues, to my consternation, was endorsed by the National Rifle Association, or the arms dealer lobby, as I like to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And another one refused to raise that tax cut on the top 1%, or rescind it, the final years of that tax cut while he was in office. So the wealthy kept getting their taxes cut while we were in a huge, you know, fiscal budgetary crisis. You know, and as usual, we know what was created by. I mean, look, in Washington, when with Obama's stimulus, they refused to put, keep the state aid funding in there.
Right.
The Republicans screamed about it, so that hurt the states. Obviously, the economy hurt the states. The fact that Governor Strickland wouldn't roll back this tax hurt us. And so that created this environment. It wasn't created out of nothing. And once it was created, that suddenly that's workers' fault, because it always is.
And Cliff, let's use Ted Strickland, your one-term Democratic governor, as an example or a case study here. I met him once when he was a member of Congress before he ran for governor, and he seemed nice enough. But I didn't get any real passion or fire or commitment out of him. I mean, Sherrod Brown is a living, breathing creature, and by comparison, Ted Strickland seems closer to a potted plant. That said, his timidity in being unwilling to confront the whole notion that taxes are evil and that we cannot raise taxes or even cut tax cuts, roll back tax cuts that were inadvised, is a disease that I think afflicts most of the Democratic Party now. And we see President Obama, you and I are talking here on the 6th of April, as the clock is running on the Republican effort to shut down the government and blame the Democrats for shutting down the government. And
right.
And Obama is still kind of floating above it, telling the leaders of Congress to work this out and bring him a resolution. But he has not given instructions, to wit, that I will veto any legislation that includes this, this, or this. And so Boehner's actually trying to contain the radical Tea Party element of his party. They want $100 billion in cuts. He's satisfied with 61. The Democrats have thrown out 33 without detailing where those cuts would come from. And so we have a Democratic Party here that is just so fearful of the tax issue, and they're allowing the Republicans to run roughshod at both the state and federal levels.
Well, don't get me started on Obama, too, because that would be dangerous. We could go on forever here. My, you know, as you said, he floats above it. He floats like a butterfly, but he doesn't sting like a bee.
Yep.
I'll tell you that. Certainly, you know, he had the bully pulpit. That sets the stage for everybody else. And so, so to me, you know, when you say floating above it, I mean, you know, we all know his MO by now. It was the same with health care. It was the same with the stimulus. It was the same with the climate bill that never got done.
Right.
It was the same with a variety of things, which is he made certain promises during the campaign, and I'm going to call them what they are because I hate euphemisms. He lied. He said he was going to fight for certain things. He said there'd be no offshore drilling. He said, you know, the public option was a key component, and on and on. He made promises to his progressive base, and in the end, when the choice was between lying and just going on and pretending that things couldn't have been done any differently and there's nothing he could do, or standing up and using that bully pulpit to campaign in states, especially back in the beginning when he had a honeymoon, a huge majorities was popular, think about back then what he could have done if he'd gone to states where Republican, so-called moderate Republicans were refusing to sign onto his bill, Maine and Pennsylvania, when Specter was still a Republican in those places, and reminded people how it was the Bush's tax cuts for the rich, it was Bush's deregulation, and really probably take it all the way back to Reagan, that this is the stuff that had destroyed our economy. Think of how he could have just reopened a new debate so that Democrats could stop being so darn timid about this stuff. And I'm not saying that it's all Obama's fault, because it's their fault, too. I'm just saying he failed on that score, and that was an important one. But I got to tell you, watching it from Ohio, it was very painful to watch as literally on the state level and in the national level, Obama and Strickland were almost mirror images of each other. Obama now, on the national Cliff, level would be scared to raise taxes. Strickland would be scared on the state level.
Cliff,
Obama would talk about government like it was a problem and not like it could be a solution. Strickland would do that. And they both, on the local level, they both brag about cutting essential government services. Obama, you know, doesn't want to give, you know, heating oil to poor people. On the local level here, you know, Strickland, who had been a prison psychologist, I mean, so who knew what he was dealing with, that was his past profession, gutted mental health services here, destroyed them, rather than raise taxes or roll back. And so, I mean, in the end, when you get, as I've said to people, I understand why you get John Kasich, because a lot of Democrats just sat here like myself, and we just, you're flabbergasted. At some point, you start wondering if there's even a choice, you know? And I'm not saying, obviously, Ted Strickland wouldn't have done this to workers, but in a whole lot of areas, as I mentioned guns before, quite frankly, Strickland, I mean, Kasich voted for the assault weapons ban in Congress. Strickland voted against it. Mm. Strickland is even more in the gun lobby's pocket than Kasich. So it's some, I mean, you know, I mean, that there's no analysis one can do if they're not willing to look at their own party sometimes and say, you know what, part of the reason we got here is you failed us.
Well, Cliff, what you just said echoes a lot of what I have been saying, and I appreciate hearing it from somebody else. Also, the way it comes off is you're a whining professional lefty. And you apparently don't know that we were written out of the script about a year ago. That, you know, we're just, we ask for too much. We hold the president to account for the things that he actually promised us during the campaign. And we really should just go curl up in a ball in the corner because they're not listening to us.
Well, that's the thing that gets me the angriest. It's simply, so he makes a bunch of promises. I mean, I named two of them. But don't ask, don't tell, which almost ended up not happening because if he dragged his feet on immigration reform, he never tried hard for. Things were...
Don't forget Guantanamo.
Guantanamo, and obviously what's happened recently with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, which sickens most of us. I mean, he made promises. He said, you know, or he was going to be the best protector, this is one of my personal favorites, of whistleblowers. Meanwhile, he's prosecuted more of them and gone after them harder than Bush did. So we get all these promises of all these wonderful things, and it's almost like, I don't know what the disconnect is, but it's almost like he tells you these lies with a smile on his face, and in the end, there's no... it just doesn't even think twice about it. Well, I lied as a matter of course, so I guess I lied. And he just moves on and says nothing could have been done any differently, that we have to accept the realities, and we're all whiners for the fact that we actually believed him or wanted to believe him when he said he was going to do certain things. Somehow we're the bad people. The guy lying to us is the good guy, but the people being lied to who are offended by it are the bad guys. And that's why I've been so disappointed, because say what you want about Bush, and believe me, I've said a lot on
your
show.
Yes, you have.
In the future. And say what you want about Clinton. I think Clinton's a better comparison, because do I like everything Bill Clinton did? No. But the difference is that the things I don't like that Bill Clinton did, welfare reform, NAFTA, he told us he was going to do. He tried to make the case to the left. He came in saying, this is what I'm doing. He didn't lie about it, whatever you want to say about it. You know, and he took the fight to the Republicans when it needed it, whereas Obama can't seem to take the fight to anybody but people on the left. So, you know, I mean, I think it's important. You can't look at the state of Ohio without looking at what happened nationally, and you can't look nationally without Ohio just because it's a key swing state. And I think the way Democrats have behaved in both has reinforced that Democrats are weak, that Democrats don't stand up for their principles, that Republicans, you know, are the people who are the adults, which is scary, who get what they want.
And that corporate leaders can bring a business mind to fix these troubled state governments on the backs of the poor, the disabled, the elderly, and those who need state services the most.
Right. I mean, look, you and I know what the truth of this whole debate is right now. You know, we're talking about Social Security and Medicare and whatever. I mean, if you took a look right now at the defense budget and realized that we almost spend as much as the rest of the world combined for a bunch of things that are very useful, items that we need, but a lot of other items that we don't need, and we were willing to cut a chunk out of that defense budget, and we were willing to look at farm subsidies and look at how certain, not the lower-end ones, but the ones that are going to big agribusiness,
right,
others, and just if we just dealt with those two things, we'd balance the budget. It'd be over. There'd be no fiscal crisis anymore. It'd be amazing. You could literally wave a magic wand and it'd be done. You wouldn't have to touch anything. There'd be no more talk about Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. So this isn't about budgets. This is about, you know, bringing us back to the form of government that these guys like, which is not only a pre-1960s government, a pre-1930s, maybe even pre-progressive era. I mean, mm-hmm. that's what they want to do, you know? So, I mean, well, one of the states, I'm trying to remember where this was. I read this article a little while back, and I don't want to pick a state out of a hat because I don't remember which one it was. There was, now I do remember. It was Missouri. Was trying to pass something. One of the lawmakers said that they should do something to back off on child labor laws.
That's actually Maine. I think it's Maine, where they have now eviscerated the child labor laws. I think they rolled it back to age 14, and there is a sub-minimum wage for underage workers.
I think it's Missouri, too, because
okay.
I remember being, I didn't want to just jump out and say it, but I think so. In fact, age of new media, I'm sitting here actually punching it in and trying to look as I talk to you.
Okay, well, you check that out, but I know it's true in Maine, because I saw Rachel Maddow do a feature on that the other night.
Which is amazing. There it is, Missouri child labor laws. Same
okay.
thing.
Uh-huh.
They tried to repeal it. It turns out the bill was defeated. But there was a state senator there who had tried to repeal child labor laws in Missouri. So, I mean, when you're looking at these things, I mean, how can anybody be mistaken and say to themselves, this is all old, drown the government in the bathtub, Grover Norquist, Ronald Reagan, government's the problem, and we can go on and on and on in quoting these guys. It has nothing to do with budgets, because as I just said, if anybody would stand up to the Blackwaters and Halliburtons of the world, and the Monsantos, who are getting God knows what, not to mention oil company subsidies, which a lot of Democrats have tried to do to their credit, and have been blocked by Blue Dogs and certain and Republicans. If you took care of those things, there'd be no budget crisis. We'd have no problems.
Well,
the fact that if we raise taxes, on the top 1% back to any normal level, considering the right loves looking back to the 1950s when apparently everything was perfect and when the top rate was 91% under Eisenhower.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the 60s, 77 and then 70% under Kennedy. I mean, we're not even talking about going back to that. We're just talking about bringing it back to what Clinton had it at, 39.6. You'd take care of everything if you did that stuff.
And Cliff, let's take a little detour here from the child labor legislation, because it's interesting. I try to follow these things. I didn't know about the effort in Missouri. I knew about the one in Maine. But these are coordinated legislative initiatives. This is not just a guy with a harebrain in Missouri and another guy with a harebrain in Maine. This
right.
is coordinated through a group called ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. They formed back in 1973. Henry Hyde, Paul Weyrich, many people remember him from the Reagan era, and John Kasich of Ohio was one of the people who was involved in ALEC in its formative years. ALEC exists to provide model legislation, and this was written by Bob Fetrakis, another great
model
mind.
Model for Somalia, you mean? Sorry, couldn't resist. Go ahead.
Model legislation, and Fetrakis describes it with one theme, how to transfer wealth to corporations while shrinking the size of government. And when you see who's behind ALEC, it's the Coke Industries, Coca-Cola, those are different words, Walmart, AT&T, Johnson & Johnson, Pfizer, ExxonMobil, and State Farm. All of the great citizen corporations of this country who pay virtually no taxes, if they do at all, and yet who spend large on lobbying to further game the system in order to protect their interests at the expense of an average citizen. And so it's important for people to understand that ALEC is this group. Also, the Mackinac Institute in Michigan is writing some of the legislation there. Likewise, they're funded by some of these same interests. And Cliff, yep. I just was reading in this article, in Cincinnati, April 28th and 29th, ALEC has its spring meeting at the Netherland Plaza Hotel.
Yeah, I saw that, actually. A friend of mine was asking me if I wanted to go. I was thinking maybe I'd go on a fun trip.
Yeah.
Do a little old Nixonian infiltration. Who knows? Maybe I'll go with a microphone and ask some nice questions.
Yeah.
There's no doubt this stuff's coordinated, because on another issue that is near and dear to my heart, which is not allowing Jared Loughners and people like that to get their hands on guns because of unbelievably, ridiculously stupid gun laws, that basically make it harder to get cold medicine than to get a gun. I mean, make it easier to get a gun than to get cold medicine.
You're right.
they have led a multi-state assault, and it's the same thing. It's, you know, it's a variation of the following: guns in churches, guns in bars, guns on college campuses, or guns for drug misdemeanors. And in this state, in Ohio, we already had the state Senate pass bills that would allow drug misdemeanors and to get their hands on guns. And, you know, misdemeanors, there are some misdemeanors. We're not just talking about somebody that smokes a joint here. We're talking about people that have sold drugs or drug paraphernalia, mm-hmm. which would have, by the way, stopped. That's the kind of law that would have allowed Jared Loughner, even if they had looked into him, you know, with a background check, because that was his problem, was having been, he'd been busted for selling drug paraphernalia.
Yeah.
And the guns in bars, not only, I mean, obviously the Fraternal Order of Police and every other police organization has come out against this as crazy, but, you know, that same legislation passed in Tennessee recently is being debated in a number of other states. You know, so this is not, you know, it's not, we're not sitting here in a silo. This is a coordinated attack going on around the country. And again, people think of guns as a completely social issue, but it is led, the people behind this, these are not citizen militia. This is not people who want to defend their home. These are big gun manufacturers who are looking at a declining gun market where fewer and fewer guns are being sold every year, and they need to find a way to gin up sales so they create crazier, a higher clip, and more insane guns all the time. And if we were to do real background checks and stop, you know, and in any way hinder the use of, you know, people who are insane from buying these guns, well, to them, they're like arms dealers anywhere in any country. An arms dealer in the United States is like an arms dealer in Yemen. A sale is a sale. They don't care who they sell to. And so any way that you're going to try to stop them from selling to people is a bad thing. And any way you're going to stop somebody from being able to, you know, who might not buy a gun because they want to use their gun in a certain place. And I'll finish my little rant by saying people think guns in bars, but it's actually guns in establishments that serve alcohol. So you're now talking about sports matches. You're talking about, and anybody who knows what Ohio State and Michigan games could be like.
Sure.
Now there may be bands actually at the stadium because it's a college, but in bars here during Ohio State Michigan, that would be a lot of fun. And certain other arenas in Ohio and Michigan might end up allowing them. And now you're talking about teams playing each other, people getting hammered in an environment where people scream and yell for their favorite team and what have you. So it's insanity. You know, and you're right about Alec, and that's what we're looking at.
Well, and Cliff, the other real shameful part of this is that the Democratic Party is in a complete stand-down on gun issues. They and this comes from the Blue Dog influence, and I also want to factor in Rahm Emanuel here, because people need to know that he was the one who recruited the self-funded, the rich Blue Dogs, who basically formed the foundation of the wobbly speakership of Nancy Pelosi. The majority was based on the wins in 2006 and 2008. And when you look at those two classes of congressional freshmen, they were, I believe in 2008, more than half of the freshman class immediately pledged Blue Dog. And so we have a situation here where the Democrats consciously recruited people who are pro-gun and anti-abortion. And now they are wondering why the party has no real force in either one of these debates. And we see that part of the ALEC plan is to roll back abortion rights at the state level. And we'll get to that in Ohio in just a second. But the twins here, where Democrats used to be so firmly pro-choice and so firmly for realistic gun regulation, not anti-Second Amendment, not anti-gun, to take it away from hunters or people who might rightly use them for self-defense, but to try to put reasonable restrictions on assault weapons, on these large clips like the one that Jared Loughner used that had more than 30 bullets.
Background checks at gun shows so you can stop the mentally disabled, as well as criminals and even terrorists. In a few cases, I could rattle them off. A number of domestic and even international terrorists got guns at gun shows. And so this is what, because all you got to do is, if you're a private seller, the nice little loophole, if you're not federally licensed, you don't have to conduct a background check.
Yeah.
So I mean, you're 100% right that these are connected, and I like to call it the Shulerization of the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Heath Shuler, yeah.
Yes. And basically, what's so shameful about that is 2006 and 2008 were wave elections for Democrats. So plenty of Democrats, some of whom sadly got knocked out this time. I think of Alan Grayson and Mary Jo Kilroy. Mm-hmm. But others who still held on, I think of John Yarmuth from Kentucky, who are in swing districts where you could have had progressives win. We instead catered to the lowest common denominator and stuck in these ridiculously pro-corporate, anti-choice, anti-gay, pro-gun Democrats. And as you're pointing out, we took away the heart and soul of the party. And in the end, look at how many of these guys lost on Election Day 2010. Because nobody wanted to vote for them. I mean, part of that was the economy, but part of that is, if you're progressive, do you really have a reason to vote for for the Heath Shulers? He held on, barely. Mm-hmm. And we'll see how much longer he does. But he was, you know, they lost over half the Blue Dog Caucus. Which, you know, right. What? That was the one thing that was worth toasting champagne to that night.
Yeah, yeah. It was the only silver lining in the so-called shellacking. But it really reminds us, too, as the Democrats gear up for 2012. And, you know, one can hope that the Democrats could hold the Senate. It seems far-fetched to imagine that they could retake the House. And Obama is vulnerable in many ways and looks good at the moment only because of the weak field of Republicans and the failure of anyone to really jump out in the lead on the Republican side. But he's vulnerable in many ways. The war in Afghanistan is a huge albatross. The health care bill, which did not satisfy me, and which includes the mandates, which will be used very effectively by Republicans against Democrats next year. The failure to really fix Wall Street and hold people accountable for the ransacking of our economy by the wealthy who continue to pay themselves obscene bonuses. And now this assault on the middle class, which is the core of the Democratic Party. He is standing by and watching as it is you know, pushed into disintegration by these corporate forces. And, you know, he's not trying to change the Citizens United decision. He's just trying to raise $1 billion.
Right.
And so the response of Democrats to the challenges they face is to be more like Republicans. And that is the ugly reality that really undermines any hope for a future that shifts these very strong currents.
No, and that's what's so difficult, and that's why I place the level of blame on Obama that I do, because I think that politics is intricately linked to culture. Culture, you can't understand one without the other. They're so important. If the political culture decides what's possible and what's not. And the truth of the matter is that, you know, you almost have to, you know, rub your eyes if you look back at history, because between about the 30s and 1980, it was just the opposite. It was Republicans all the time trying to pretend they were Democrats, because liberalism was what controlled this country. It was what reigned.
Yeah.
And after Reagan, you get this change where he stood up as a leader does. He was a great leader. He was what he led on, I think, was mostly terrible. Was not good for this country. But at least he stood up and he set his principles, and that's what we all thought we were going to get in Obama this time. That, you know, we didn't have to wait 50 years. We had to wait, you know, about 30. We thought they'd had their run, but now we're going to go back to an era where Republicans are going to have to pretend to be Democrats because their politics has been completely discredited. Their view of the economy has been completely discredited. They're scandal-plagued. Bush has a 20% approval rating going out of office. Huge Democratic majorities, huge energy, huge grassroots list, 13 million people part of OFA. I mean, all these assets going for you. And then Obama comes in and immediately cuts a deal that's terrible on the stimulus, starting off both the economy and his presidency on a terrible note, and refuses to even mention Bush's name or argue what he believes in the fact that deregulation and tax cuts and all the rest of the stuff had been what had gotten us here.
And Cliff, to that very point, last night I exercised poor judgment and I spent 20 minutes watching Sean Hannity on Fox News. And in a 20-minute period, he uttered the phrase, Obama's $5 trillion deficit, 6 times. Now, it's a lie, all right? And it runs unchallenged by the president, his spokespeople, and those who ran the most effective campaign in my lifetime. And to allow Obama to be saddled with the deficits and the long-term structural debt that was George Bush's and the Republicans' responsibility, their tax policies created this mess, yet they get away with blaming Obama for it, and it's starting to stick, just like the lie that he's a Muslim and that he wasn't born here.
That's exactly right. I mean, you know, that's part of when you don't need, you know, part of defense is playing a good offense. Obviously, you need to defend yourself, but part of it is when you keep the other side consistently on defense, when you consistently, you know, I mean, a party that's so wed to corporations as the Republicans are, which, you know, I'm not to say the Democrats don't have some of the same problems, but they're not nearly as bad because the Republicans are so bad, and did not come in after that election and after the mandate he was given and after, you know, the 53%, which I think was the best any Democrat had done since FDR, you know, and all everything he had going for him, all the energy behind him, first black president and the huge majorities, and to not push to redefine the conversation of that moment and to remind people that it was Republicans who loved corporations and Republicans who genuflected before them and Republicans who cut their taxes and sent their jobs over, you know, across the ocean to China and, mm-hmm. and the rest. To not do that was malpractice. It was political malpractice. And so, you know, people have short memories. People have busy lives. They're doing things. And, of course, that's what happened. All this stuff from Afghanistan to the debt to everything else came to be Obama's. He came to own it because he stopped reminding people whose fault it was, and he stopped standing up saying what he believed in, why it was different, and what he was going to do to fight to fix it.
Yeah.
Here we are, you know? 2010, as an example, never had to happen that way. It just didn't.
I agree. And just we're agreeing, but I just want to add one other point, and that is the rollover on extension of the Bush tax cuts for the top 2% was completely avoidable. That was a train that left the station 10 years before it arrived, and they had plenty of ways to deal with that, most notably calling a vote before the midterm elections. Even if the Democrats lost that vote, it would have been a very clear definition of the differences between the parties. But Harry Reid is a very weak leader, and he doesn't like to take chances. He doesn't like to stand and lose. And I just have to get in one more jab. I watched a clip of him basically saying that he would never allow anybody to come to the United States from Guantanamo, even for a trial. And so he really is complicit with some of the worst compromises with the Republicans in undermining the Obama agenda. And I didn't want Sharon Angle to beat him, but I sure wish the Democrats had relieved him of his duties as the majority leader, because he's a sellout most of the time.
Well, yeah, I would say there are a lot of people that are complicit, and sadly, Harry Reid, in too many cases, has been too weak for my liking, too. But in the end, you know, it's sort of, the way I look at it is, the Obama agenda could never get any further than Obama, mm-hmm. because I don't think he wanted to have that vote before the midterms. I don't think they wanted to win that vote in the end. I don't think they wanted to piss off their big contributors, who they wanted to amass $1 billion worth. Sorry if I'm being conspiratorial, mm-hmm. but there is just no reason I could see to not hold that vote before the election and show the differences between the parties.
Yeah.
The only conclusion I can come to is they didn't want it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we end up getting in the end, and it's obviously bad for government and it hurts government revenue and. We're all paying the price now, sadly.
Cliff, a couple of more items on the agenda there in Ohio. What are the abortion rights rollbacks that the legislature has either considered or passed?
Well, the one that they're working on, and I'm not sure, it would be illegal under Roe, so as long as Roe is not overturned, it wouldn't be a problem. But the one of these crazy state representatives, her name is Lynn Wachtman, introduced legislation that would forbid an abortion in any case where the fetus had a detectable heartbeat, which sometimes is as soon as 18 days
right.
into a pregnancy. And they literally did the of course, over-the-top ridiculous thing of bringing in a fetus to testify.
Oh.
Yes, they brought in a woman and they hooked her up a microphone, I don't know to where and how the hell they did it. But that was their horse and pony show to roll back abortion.
Okay. Now, one of the other issues that's percolating there is a voter ID law. And as you know, I've been very concerned about Ohio as the scene of a massive election fraud in 2004, when it's very clear in the forensic analysis that John Kerry did win Ohio and that Karl Rove and the Secretary of State,
Blackwell.
Thank you. J. Kenneth Blackwell was really at the switch there. The voter ID law, what's the status of that? This is a way of suppressing turnout and participation by minorities and elderly people who don't happen to have a driver's license or other photo ID.
Right. I mean, it is what it always is, which is if, you know, they're certain groups of people, obviously, that Republicans obviously do worse if they vote, and we all know who they are, and so Republicans are trying to do their usual thing, and so I think for this one, they have to, it's at the polling place the day of election, they need proof of identity. I'm trying to think of what they need. You need a number of other, obviously, forms of ID, but I'm trying to think of exactly what I may be missing, and you may know better than me, Peter, so I apologize if that's the case of what the exact requirements are.
I don't know the terms of the legislation, so I haven't seen that detail.
I must apologize. I don't know all the terms of it either.
It's
I can only keep up with so many assaults on.
Yeah, right.
But it's obviously it's attempt to curtail rights. I mean, anytime Republicans bring up these issues, that's what they're going for.
And finally, on election issues, Fetrakis and Wasserman, right there in Columbus, they have been stalwarts on election integrity and helped carry the lawsuits challenging the phony results from 2004. They reported that Ohio's 2010 unadjusted election exit poll results showed that Ted Strickland, the Democrat, defeated John Kasich by a margin of 50.1 to 47.4. But they write, when Kasich won, the actual vote on the voting machines provided in service by private Republican-connected vendors, then the exit pollsters adjusted the exit poll numbers to match the machine count. And I believe the official tally was Kasich winning by 2 points. Is that right?
That sounds right. I think 49-47 sounds familiar.
Yeah, yeah. So has there, I realize the media in Ohio is not, it leaves a lot to be desired, but has there been any outcry that John Kasich is an illegitimate governor?
None whatsoever. And I was not even aware of what you just said until you said it.
Really?
No, I wasn't.
The Post-Dispatch is not on the case there, huh?
Believe it or not, they are not.
Yeah.
As I said, you keep up with some of this stuff, but you know, there's so much of it, it's hard to keep up with everything. So,
wow.
So, I mean, it's a constant. It's a struggle.
Yeah, it sure is.
The politics you have out there. So here, look, I mean, I thought to do your listeners justice, we should tell them more about this bill, and I quickly punch something in while I'm talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what I'm saying is it would be the most restrictive voter ID law. I don't believe we've passed it yet, but obviously they're discussing it. They have to show government-issued photo IDs at the polls, show one of four forms of ID when voting in person. They must show an Ohio's driver's license, state ID, military ID, or passport. And of course, there are people who can't get one of these forms of ID. They may not drive. There are many exceptions. In any case, from what I'm reading here, that it would be the most draconian in the entire country, which isn't a surprise they would be doing that here. And, of course, they don't tell people, they don't publicize any of this, so often you wouldn't find out till the day of the election. You'd arrive and find out that you need one of these forms of ID or you're not voting.
Sure, yeah. Well, Cliff, I want to thank you for staying there and really continuing to maintain your presence during this critical time. I know that you and like-minded individuals in Ohio are fighting, and yet the Republican machine is extremely powerful. And so I want to thank you for updating us, and we certainly wish you the best in what appears to be a declining future in the great state of Ohio.
Let's hope it changes. Thanks very much, Peter. I appreciate you having me on, as always.
Cliff Schechter in Columbus, just up the road from... the battle between corporate politicians and the middle class continues in the Middle West. And let's just move north from Ohio to Michigan. Michigan has a new Republican governor, Rick Snyder, not to be confused with Rick Scott of Florida or Scott Walker of Wisconsin. These are the political leaders who have come out of nowhere with a common agenda to pass legislation to bust unions and to transfer a lot of benefits to the wealthy. And in Michigan, they're taking it from retired people, from the unemployed. And it's all about money. Or is it? Joining me now is Ray Boersma, B-W-R-S-M-A. He is a community columnist for the Holland Sentinel newspaper, and that's based in the beautiful city of Holland, Michigan, on the west coast of Michigan, on Lake Michigan there. And Ray, welcome to our program today.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You wrote a column that drew the attention of one of my listeners all the way in Hawaii. And according to the Holland Sentinel website, your column has gotten 18,000 people on Facebook to say they liked it.
Yeah, that's about 17,900 more than I usually get liking my column. So that was nice to hear.
So before we get into the meat of your rant, and it's a powerful one that may piss off many of the people who are listening to this program, tell us a little bit about yourself and how long you've been writing a column for the Sentinel.
Oh, okay. Well, first of all, I'm a middle-aged man. Have my family here in Holland. I grew up in Holland. It's kind of a conservative area. I have never quite fit that mold, although I consider myself to be somewhat of a moderate.
So you never worked for the DeVos family at Amway?
No, I didn't. But I actually have a distant relative who does.
Uh-huh.
And he likes his job.
Yeah.
He likes his job.
Yeah.
But anyway, I've been writing, I'm trying to remember exactly how many years it's been. I want to say about probably maybe 7 or 8. I first started writing a lot to the Sentinel when I opposed the war in Iraq, and I came out in opposition even before the action was declared or started.
Because you and I both knew that he wasn't sitting on weapons of mass destruction and had no connections to 9/11, right?
Well, to me, it was just a matter of simple logic. We had a vice president who said Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, and we know right where they are. Well, okay, if you know right where they are, and there are UN inspectors, all you have to do is tell those inspectors where they are, and those inspectors can find them. So, of course, it didn't make any sense. But I was also opposed to the action in Iraq. I lost a brother in Vietnam. So that made me very cautious. I'm thinking about the people who I knew were going to lose children,
yeah,
brothers and sisters in Vietnam. And you've got to understand this. I saw this from the point of view of a son looking at his parents who lost one of their children. You just can't believe the heartache. Now, I realize that some wars have to be fought. I don't like war, but mm-hmm. I realize some have to be fought. So
understood.
Anyway,
yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, I was I came out in opposition. I was pretty much there were a lot of people who didn't like me at that time, but later on, I feel that my stance was vindicated.
Well, it doesn't sound. I mean, we've just met here, Ray, but it doesn't sound like you're a guy who writes hoping to be popular with your neighbors.
I made up my mind a long time ago that I have to speak what I believe. As long as what I believe is based on logic and reason, and I just let the chips fall where they will. I don't go out to antagonize anybody, at least not normally. I just want people to think a little bit, and that's my goal in writing, to just get people to think about some things.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in this area, there are people who have minds made up just based on tradition, based on teachings that have come down from generations. I don't always think that's the wisest way to come up with decisions, make decisions, and come up with conclusions.
Mm-hmm. And, Ray, talk a little bit about what it's like to live in modern-day Michigan, the state that has been hardest hit by the recession because it affected the auto industry, which was already sliding and facing its own set of issues. But I would argue that Michigan is the hardest hit state in the United States by the economic downturn that is also fueled by the excessive spending on wars and other issues that are well beyond the control of you and your fellow citizens.
Well, statistically, I don't think anybody can argue with you. We have been hit very hard economically. Yes, the war, of course, costs our entire nation, but I think the greater problem in Michigan has been outsourcing work. The decline in the auto industry, of course, and you know, I'm going to tell you the truth. Some of that decline has been caused by the automakers themselves. Mm-hmm. I don't deny that, but a lot of it has been caused, I think, by our national policies and how we view manufacturing and where that manufacturing should take place.
So the column that you wrote that got all this attention, and my thanks to John Zweibel, one of my loyal listeners who is comfortably retired in Hawaii, but it got his attention, and he sent me an email, and he said, call this guy. And I don't typically take orders from my listeners, but after I read this after I read this column, I said, okay.
Okay, all right.
So you wrote a piece, and you opened up by saying that you're going to offend people, and if people don't want to be offended, they ought to just jump to the sports section or something.
Well, that seems to be a fair warning. Like I said, I don't try to antagonize people, but sometimes if you're going to make a point, sometimes you have to be direct, and I think I was direct.
And here is your indictment. So you're an American employee. Maybe you make car parts. Maybe you're an engineer or designer. Maybe you're an accountant, store clerk, or tradesman. Whatever you do, you're probably stupid or lazy. Yes, I wrote it, and I mean it. You are either stupid or lazy, maybe both. Now, that's quite a broadside, Ray.
That's exactly what I wrote. But I think the next paragraph, and I don't know if you plan to read that or not, but the next paragraph tells a little bit more about why I came up to that claim. Now I'll be happy to tell your listeners what I meant.
Let me read the next paragraph, and then you can go into your explanation.
Okay.
Now, I'm not referring to your work ethic or job performance. No, most of you are competent and devoted to your profession or vocation. I'm addressing the way you view economics and employment. I'm challenging your gumption to advocate for yourself and your fellow Americans. Here's what I mean. Remember the Reagan standard? Are you better off today than you were a decade ago, two decades, three? Well, unless you make more than $380,000 a year, the answer is no. In fact, your standard of living over the last quarter century has actually decreased while millionaires have added 30% to their net wealth. And why is it that that makes the average worker lazy and stupid, Ray?
Well, first of all, you know, as you were reading that to me, I just thought, boy, that sounds really good. I like that. But anyway, okay.
I'll do your answering machine message too, if you'd like that.
Okay. Well, I'm still waiting for a chance to have the guy on NPR's show do that for me.
Right. Wait. Don't tell me.
Yes.
Carl
yes, but
Castle.
I'll have you as a standby. Okay.
Okay.
Okay, well, anyway, yeah, what makes the Americans lazy or stupid? You know, when you don't seek out information that you really need to seek out, or when you have information and you don't apply it, that's it. I'll be blunt, that's stupid. Unless you just didn't want to. And if you just didn't want to, if you didn't want to take the time to do something that you should have done, that makes you lazy. And in my opinion, Americans need to understand what got us into the situation where people are losing jobs left and right, primarily in manufacturing, and not doing anything about it. And it has to do with so many of our jobs going overseas.
Yeah.
Now, I understand the value of getting something as cheaply as I can. You wouldn't believe the coupon books that I keep at my house. Mm-hmm. Okay, every time my wife and I go out, she says to me, where do you have a coupon for, Ray? Because she knows we're not going out to eat unless I have that coupon.
I think that's in the Michigan DNA. All my relatives in Michigan are the best retail shoppers in the world.
Oh,
they never,
absolutely.
ever pay retail, Roy.
Yeah,
Ray, I'm
and
sorry.
That, and that that Dutch blood of mine also calls to be a little bit on the cheap side. But,
yeah.
But you know what? I also understand that cheapness does not always pay, because it can ruin an economic system. If all I ever did was go to a place where we had coupons, and that restaurant, for instance, everybody had those coupons. You know, it doesn't take a brain surgeon to realize that sooner or later that place is going to go out of business.
Mm-hmm.
They need to have a fair return. It's the same for the American worker. If everything I buy is made from someplace other than America, then American workers are going to struggle. And yes, there are times I'm going to have to pay more for something. And it's hard. Try to find something made in America these days. Even the American flag is made in China.
Well, and Ray, this is a whole interesting evolution, because when Walmart first started, they only sold American-made goods. That was part of their whole framing and the pitch that they made to the consumers. But
well,
I was not
aware of that, but I find it interesting that you're saying so.
Yeah, and so as time developed and their big box stores were so successful, they changed that ethic, and they have become the largest importer of retail goods from China. I can't think of anybody who's larger, but I don't have the stats in front of me, so I could be a little off base on it. But we know that consumers flock to Walmart, and you've got a chain in Michigan called Myers. They call it Shifty Acres.
Some do. Some.
Right. But Myers has managed to survive with Walmart in a competitive position, but they too have had to buy far more imported goods in order to compete on a price level. And so we do have to look at American consumers and their behavior, because this happened when we were flush. It was in the 90s that people made the shift to buying far more imported goods, and that's when our trade deficit with China shot up during the Clinton years. And he proposed NAFTA and these other trade deals, which I never supported, as a way to try to hedge against the globalization. But during the good times of the 1990s is kind of when we set this pattern of dismissing job layoffs. And during the 90s, Clinton never uttered a word when profitable companies started downsizing and reducing their payrolls, because the economy was growing, profits were good, the market was doing well, and he was creating a surplus in the federal budget. But I believe that the erosion really started under Clinton. Do you agree, or do you have a different view?
Well, based on what I know, I would have to agree with you, because the earliest recollection I have of, I guess you would call it mega outsourcing, I think it did start with Clinton. I remember the NAFTA agreements being debated and whether or not that was good. And, you know, I still remember Ross Perot. You know, he was kind of a funny-looking guy with that funny-sounding voice.
Sure.
And he gave that warning, what's that great sucking sound? And none of us listened to him. We just kind of blew him off. And, you know, when I wrote my original column, the one that you read, I had written in there that I was just as stupid as the people who I was criticizing. Now, I only get 650 words. Once I get that limit, I have to start making adjustments.
Mm-hmm.
So I cut that part out, but I'm not going to deny it. I was as stupid as most Americans. I was told that this will enhance our economy, that we will be better off. And I think the results show much to the contrary.
And, Ray, part of your piece here, let me go into this next. Second, you bought into the myth, this is where you're calling people stupid and lazy, You bought into the myth that unions are the cause of America's demise. You didn't bother to learn America became a world power when union membership was at its peak. You didn't bother to learn America became the envy of the world while one of every three Americans was a union member. And I would build on your comment there and say that it really pains me to see people who were able to move into the middle class, who are not members of a union, who think that unions are their enemy, because the 40-hour work week, overtime pay, guaranteed vacation, employer-paid health care and retirement benefits, those all came from the work of organized labor and collective bargaining. And then corporate managers extended those same terms to their non-union workforce for a simple reason: to prevent more unions from being from growing in their workplaces.
Well, and I would agree with what you just stated. That's the way I see it. And for people not to understand that it's not a long chain of cause and effect, and people should be able to recognize that A leads to B and B leads to C and C to D. I'm not asking people to recognize how A goes all the way to Z. It's not that complicated, and yet there are so many people who just seem to, they just don't want to buy into that thinking, and I don't understand it. It's simple logic to me.
Now, Ray, I want to ask you your thoughts about the problems in Detroit, and I have two areas I'd like to explore. One is that the case was made that the costs of union auto workers, including the health care benefits for retirees, the pension plan both for current workers and retirees, and the hourly wages that they were being paid were not sustainable against the competition from foreign manufacturers who manufactured overseas and the foreign manufacturers who built facilities in the United States in the last 15 years, largely in right-to-work states and largely in the South. Alabama has a Hyundai plant. I think they make Nissan automobiles there, and I think there's a Toyota plant there as well. And those people are new hires. They've only been on the job, say, 10 years or less. And they are being paid sharply less, both in terms of the cash in their paychecks and in the benefits, particularly as compared to Detroit-based auto workers. And so it pains me to see that the average person seems to think that the solution there is not to require the Alabama automakers to extend the same benefits that people in Detroit earned, but instead to strip the people who work in Detroit of the benefits that they earned over a 50 or 60 year period of collective bargaining.
It's a race to the bottom, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's sad. That's sad. I don't understand why so many American workers are just content to say, well, everybody else is losing, let's lose too. I don't quite understand that. And in my article, as you already read, you know, the rich are getting richer. We the middle class, I don't call myself poor, but we the middle class actually are seeing, in real dollars, we are seeing a slight decrease. And I just don't understand that. I guess greed still runs rampant, but we should have some people who are looking out for us, who at least want to see us have a reasonable share of the pie.
Well,
I don't know if that's the right way to put it. But
Ray, isn't it in the interests of corporate America to have a healthy middle-class consumer base who can buy their product?
Yeah, I'll never forget this little tidbit, this little story that my dad told me. I don't know if it's true or not, but he told it to me. My dad was a union worker. He was a factory rat. He came from the Netherlands, had like a great education, but he was a smart guy. Anyway, came over from the Netherlands, settled here in Holland, Michigan, worked in a steel plant making truck parts. And he told me this story a couple times. There was a tour being conducted at one of the Ford factories, and Henry Ford was going with one of the union honchos. I don't know who the guy's name was, but Ford had just introduced some automotive technology that required less workers. And as they were walking through the plant, he turned to the union head and said something about, well, take a look at that. That machine's not going to give you much in the line of union workers, is it? And the union guy turned to Henry Ford and said something like, you're right. And neither is it going to allow somebody to get a paycheck so that they can buy your car.
Right.
So I don't know if that's a true story or not, but it sure sounded good.
Well, and Ray,
and that's true. You know, economy is about money moving. That's really what it's about. It's about money circulating. And if you don't have people to have money which can circulate, that affects your business.
Ray, earlier this year, I was in Detroit during Super Bowl weekend.
How nice
and
for you.
The family got together, and we watched the game. And the Detroit area residents were all just agog at the Chrysler commercial starring Eminem. And it really profiled Detroit as a gritty but can-do town. It used the line imported from Detroit. Eminem closes the commercials by saying, this is what we do. And this was to promote the new edition of the Chrysler 200. And I was really struck by the way even the stations that didn't carry the Super Bowl played that two-minute commercial for free. And the whole city was abuzz, and there was a sense of pride and renewal and identification with Detroit. And a comment that I made at the time was, well, but the people who are building the Chrysler 200 make $14 an hour, have to pay more than historically for health benefits, and they get a 401k that'll probably be worth almost nothing if and when they actually do reach retirement age. And the biggest problem is the people who build the Chrysler 200 can't afford to buy one.
Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. I see what you're saying. Well, it's obviously very true that the average manufacturing man or woman has taken a hit over the last decade. And I think it's because of our policies, and we'll go back to the phrase race to the bottom. You know, when you're competing with overseas workers who work for $5-$10 a day, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
I know that there are dangers to protectionism. I understand that. But there are also benefits to some degree. If I'm not mistaken, and I don't know this for sure, but as I researched this column, I believe that Germany has some protectionism for its workers. So if there is a country that wants to sell something to Germany, then they must, in return, buy something from Germany,
mm-hmm.
of the equivalent amount or close to it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, now, so you're still allowing for some measure of trade, but at the same time, you're protecting your workers. And that seems reasonable to me. I don't know if other people disagree with that policy, that philosophy, but it seems reasonable to me.
Well, and that's where we use the term fair trade instead of free trade, because free trade really allows capital to control the decision-making and the flow of money and goods. And also, it allows them to move labor to the place where they can exploit it for the absolute least. And we saw, for example, the failed effort at NAFTA led to the maquiladoras just over the border in Mexico, these manufacturing plants run by multinationals that were hiring Mexican workers to produce goods that had formerly been made in the United States. And it only lasted 2 or 3 years before those firms offshored even further to places that were even lower cost than Mexico. And
right.
So once you lower the gates and you start this process, it's very hard to close the gates and get that horse back into the corral.
And why is it, Peter, that it's so difficult for so many Americans to understand that? Why is it so hard for people to realize that there's a national interest that we have to consider? interest is the citizens of this country, the working citizens.
Yeah.
Like I said, some people are either stupid or lazy, and it's frustrating. I hate to say that. I know that there are people who make a living by shock radio, by shock writing, and so on. That was certainly not my intention. I don't try to do these things just to get people to read. I find it interesting that this is a piece of writing. Well, there are a lot of people who read it, and I don't know if it's just because I called them stupid or lazy. That was never my intent to get them to read just by doing so. But I find it to be a sad situation. I really do.
Ray, I want to get your take on the bailouts for two of the three major Detroit automakers, because I offended some of my friends in the UAW and the labor movement in general by opposing the bailouts that were first proposed by President Bush in his last few weeks in office, because he said we simply cannot allow General Motors to go into bankruptcy. And $100 billion later, General Motors went into bankruptcy. And they came out, and by all accounts, it did not cause the world to come to an end. And my take on it was that the loans to the Detroit automakers, and Ford was cashed up and didn't take them, but in particular to Chrysler, a company that was owned by an investment banking firm that was basically speculating on a play around Chrysler. But fundamentally, I opposed the loans because I felt that they were used to facilitate shutting down plants and laying off workers. And I would like to have seen the same amount of money, and the Cash for Clunkers deal came close to this, used to stimulate demand for cars. And if the United States government had told the chairman of General Motors, Rick Wagoner, I think was his name, look, you can keep your job if you produce 100,000 cars that are hybrids or electrics that get somewhere upwards of 40 miles per gallon within 2 years. And we will buy those cars from you. You don't owe us anything. We're going to set the standards of what kinds of cars we're willing to buy. And that's the way we're going to induce Detroit to move into cars that are more fuel efficient, that help us reduce our imported oil requirements, and that can reduce the amount of carbon emissions that we're putting into the environment. I saw that as a win-win-win-win formula. But instead, Obama really just built on what Bush had started. And while it's good that General Motors has paid back most of the money it was owed, and that General Motors and Ford both had profitable quarters in the first quarter of 2011, I don't think that we really helped that industry move forward in a positive way. I think we helped them retrench and enhance shareholder value without really contributing much to the U.S. economy.
Well, you're giving an example of a very important, complex issue, and that is the role of government in deciding the direction of a certain market. And I am not a complete capitalist where I say, okay, we're going to just let the free market decide until there's some huge problem that causes us grief beyond description. For instance, all right, we've been importing oil for decades, obviously, and every president we have had said we have to get off this foreign oil dependence. We cannot afford this. It's costing our nation too much. There may come a day when we really end up biting a bullet hard for this one. And you know what? If all we did was just let the market go as it is, there might come a time when we find ourselves just shattered by our oil dependency. Some severe problem happens in the Middle East, and all of a sudden we are without oil. Okay? To me, that's unacceptable. We cannot let a free market situation cause us to get in a condition where we face just financial economic ruin because of some event on the other side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's foolish. That's foolish. But on the other hand, the free market does work well in many respects and in many regards. So, you know, you gave me an example of how much play the government should have. What should its role be? And I'm going to tell you that I don't know the specific answer to this specific case. I can't tell you that. My response is we've got to have government officials that see a big picture, that have an idea of how we're going to get from A to B and all the little steps that it's going to take there, and not just let world situations control our reactions. So I don't know if that's an answer that you like, Peter, but I think that's about my take on it.
All
I don't
right.
know if I can get more specific than that.
I can understand. Now, let me turn to the current situation in Michigan, because like many states, you have a new governor, a former business leader named Rick Snyder, and you have a Republican-dominated legislature. Both houses are controlled by the Republicans. Give us a quick list of what Governor Snyder has done since he took office, particularly related to unemployment benefits, to taxing pensions, and his approach to unionized state workers.
Well, a lot of the plans are still being made. And there's a little bit, you know, the reaction that the public workers have had in Wisconsin and Ohio,
and
it's not been pleasant there.
Yeah, Indiana, too.
And Indiana, too. So, you know, now the arms have been cut off, the legs have been cut off. If he gets Michigan in the same situation, the heart has been gutted. Let's put it that way. But there are some forces. I'm a teacher. I'm a unionized teacher, and we're watching very closely to see what's going to happen. And I don't know what's going to happen. I don't think Governor Snyder wants us to be another Wisconsin, another Ohio, another Indiana. But I think if he got the same results without all the commotion, he would probably be happy to mm-hmm. have that situation.
Now, let's take them one at a time here.
Sure.
Michigan, in years past, exempted pension benefits from the state income tax as a way to try to keep the snowbirds from leaving Michigan entirely.
Okay, yeah,
and,
right.
And so right. Snyder took a look at that and said, nope, that's not fair. We're going to tax pensions. Now, he may have some legitimate point about fairness, but the whole idea was to induce people who have made some money in Michigan to leave at least some of it there when they retire.
Yeah, I understand that. This is one of those two-edged sword type of deals. I understand there. You know, there's an argument to be made for, okay, well, why should income through pensions not be taxed when other income is? I understand that argument, but I also understand the argument that, okay, if you do the statistical work, generally those who are living on pensions don't have quite the resources that other people have to. So this is, for me, this is one of the issues that I could see both ways.
But Ray, wouldn't it be fair to tax pensions over a certain amount, and I don't care what the number is, but $100,000 or $200,000 a year, because this broad swipe is going to tax the pensions of teachers and former sanitation workers whose pensions are $2,000, maybe $3,000 a month, $35,000-$40,000 a year. And
right.
the tax burden on lower income pensioners is very different from
yep.
the people who live in the Tony sections of Detroit.
Yep, and I would agree with you. I would not have any qualms with having some type of cutoff. My phone is battery's dying. I'm going to switch phones. Can you hold on?
Yeah, go right ahead.
I'm sorry
That's fine.
About this.
Uh-huh.
Hold on. All right, you still there, Peter?
Yes, I am. I'm just
okay.
I'm writing
yeah,
down the time here.
That would make a lot of sense to me. I'm also one who's in favor of a graduated tax rate. Michigan does not have a graduated tax rate. I know many other states do. Look, I'm not a lower-class guy. I'm a middle-class guy right now. And quite frankly, I think I have a bit of a greater responsibility to pay for my share of this state's resources and services than perhaps the guy who's making $15,000 a year. Mm-hmm. All right, that's the price I pay for being a little bit more financially solvent than some of the other people are. I don't have a problem with that, and I get a little irritated when those who have the most blessings complain the most if they have to chip in the most. Right. That's my point of view.
Yeah, that's when they tell us that we're taxing success and we're punishing success.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I feel it's no. You're taxing the blessings that you have received. Mm-hmm. Have you worked hard for them? Yes. So has that guy who's stocking shelves at some grocery store. He's working hard for it too. He's just not making as much as you are.
Now,
so
Ray,
I don't think that's unfair, but. You know, there are people who disagree with you and me about that.
Ray, just in the last week or two, Republicans and I believe Governor Snyder have embraced a proposal to cut unemployment benefits, to shorten the number of weeks that someone would receive, and to reduce the amount of money. And I find this so deeply insulting because rich people don't use unemployment, or if they receive it, it's, money to pay their golf fees with. But, you know, unemployment is an insurance fund.
Right.
The workers who apply for unemployment are not asking for a bailout or a handout or a freebie. They are entitled to this because a certain amount of money was deducted from their paychecks and the employer matched it to buy the unemployment insurance. And for wealthy people and corporate interests to arbitrarily cut these benefits, both in the amount and the length of time, is crueler than anything I think Charles Dickens or even Charles Darwin could have imagined.
Charles Dickens would probably write a book about it. I've read a lot of his books, and he would be a little irritated by what's going on. In one of my columns, I've written for over half a dozen years now, but to me there seems to be some logic of tying, and I'm not sure what formula would exactly be used, but tying the opportunities for unemployment insurance to the jobless rate. Okay, if we're down at 2%, you obviously are going to have a lot greater chance to get a job than if you have 10%, 12% unemployment. I mean, let's face it, if there's no jobs to be had, what do you want these people to do? So I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Ray, because Rick Scott, the new governor in Florida, is proposing something loosely based on what you just said.
Okay.
And here's the problem I have. If I work in a certain field, like media, okay, and
sure.
I lose my job and it takes me 2 years to find a new job,
mm-hmm.
that's very different from somebody who's a cashier or a highly skilled computer technician or a somebody who's got 10 years experience in the financial sector. And so I think it's a real slippery slope because each person's unemployment situation is different, sometimes unique. And to say that because the overall unemployment rate went down, the fact that you just got fired, well, okay, you only need 20 weeks, not 26 weeks of benefit.
Well, I will admit that I don't have all the technicalities worked out. I see more of this as a guideline, as a standard. Obviously, there's going to be exceptions, and you know the old adage that the devil's in the details.
Yeah.
But if there are no jobs around, people need a hand. If there are jobs and people are not willing to avail themselves of the jobs that do exist, well, okay, then you've got a little bit of a problem yourself with perhaps selectivity. Like I said, I don't know. I don't have a plan structured.
Mm-hmm.
It's more of a philosophy, and I think overall the philosophy has a certain amount of merit.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. Well, let me ask you about one other draconian measure that Rick Snyder has signed into law, and that is that he can now, as governor of Michigan, declare a municipality or a government district to be insolvent, and he can then send in an emergency administrator who, with approval from the governor, can cancel contracts, including union contracts, can restructure the finances of that entity, and can even fire the elected officials who the people in that area chose to run that government entity. And I find this astounding, Ray, because this is dictatorial power vested in one person. And to imagine, I'm sure there are a lot of people who think, well, that's what Detroit needs. Detroit needs a tough love business guy to come in there and just restructure it entirely. But
mind is racing back to, I think, ninth grade history. Didn't the Romans have some people with power like that? I'm serious. They were called consuls or something like that? And when under certain circumstances, they had these huge powers granted to them.
Right.
At least
in the Bible, the Pharisees seem to have that power.
Well, I know quite a bit about the Bible. I think that was a little bit different, but to grant yourself and to talk your legislature into granting you, let's face it, it's almost supreme power. It's like, that's not the way our government is supposed to work. Our founding fathers would have really objected to something like that. They wouldn't have tolerated that. That's ridiculous, even at the state level. It's not the principles on which a democracy runs. That's for sure. That's for sure.
So, Ray, do you think the people of Michigan are smart enough? I know, you didn't just limit your stupid and lazy to people in Michigan, but let's focus right now. Is there pushback? Are people saying, wait a minute, this is simply not right, and I cannot support these political leaders who are promoting these policies?
Well, now that's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that, but I can give you just a little clue. Snyder, when he became governor, I don't know what his approval, the first day of the job, somebody's polling to see how well you approve of someone, and I don't know what that approval rating is, but it's already below 50%. So the question is, why is he in the 40s already? He's only been in office 100 days, I think there are people in Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana who are experiencing their buyer's remorse, and I think people are predicting what might happen here and already expressing that buyer's remorse. Obviously, he will have some supporters. The question is, what percentage of our population will support him? I don't know the answer to that question. I know people who say, yep, he's doing the right thing. Not to me, he's not. Not to me, he's not. You know, in the big scheme of things, what's the fairest way? What's the fairest way to make sure that everybody, I guess, has their equal responsibility, equal share? And I can't think of anything better than perhaps some type of income tax. Well, that's not what's happening here. He's cutting the financial compensation or benefits for people, just selected classes, government workers, those on a pension. I don't get that. I just don't get that. If he raises the tax rate, which, by the way, was lowered quite a bit when we had another Republican governor who just did not foresee. We had a governor named Engler,
right.
And when our economy was flush, when things were going well in the 90s, when we had a surplus of money, instead of saving for a rainy day, well, let's cut the tax rate. Okay, cut the tax rate. Then things started going south, and what happened? Well, now we don't have enough money. Well, do you raise the tax rate again? No. That's a horrible cry to raise taxes in this day and age. That's the death knell to a politician. It's, why not? Okay, why not? Why can we not expect the citizenry of a state to have to pay for the state? Why can we not expect the citizenry of a country to expect to pay for the expenses of that country? I just don't get it. But, our national tax, too. What's the highest rate we have right now? 35%, 37%?
In there, yeah, 36, I think.
Look at it. Look at that historically. Go Google that. See what the maximum tax rate has been over the last 50, 100 years in our country. 35% is minuscule to what it's normally been. 35% is minuscule to most every other Western nation in this world.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand where people think that they are being taxed to death. Do I like having more of the money that I earn available to me? Yes. But I also like roads that are nice without potholes. I like that. I like having the knowledge that there is a soldier someplace and who's defending me, and he's getting a fair amount for what he does, a fair wage salary for what he does. There are prison guards who keep the prisoners locked up so that I don't have them running in front of my house. You know, you don't get things for free, and you've got to be willing to sacrifice some of what you consider to be your hard-earned money for the good of yourself and the good of the state. That's the way I see it.
Well, Ray, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for your candid comments in your column. I want to direct people, and I will link to your column at thehollandsentinel.com. And I really appreciate you speaking up on these issues. And just one more thing. I'd like all of my listeners within a 90-mile radius to descend on Holland when the tulips are in bloom. I know Russell and Royal Oak will come over. But tell us when you predict the tulips will be in full bloom this year.
Well, usually they are in full bloom for about 2.5 to 3 weeks. Generally speaking, from the last week of April to mid-May is the best time.
Mm-hmm.
And I do want you to know that one of my little jobs that I have, I do it for fun, is that I'm actually a, they call them step-on tour guides. I go on a bus of tourists, and I wear my Dutch costume, and I drive them around the city. Well, the bus driver does the driving, but I take them around the city, and I tell them about the history of our town in my Dutch costume. And I'm blessed that I even know a little bit of Dutch, so I speak to them in Dutch, and we have a good time. So if you have any listeners who come to Holland and want to tour the city, tell them to give me a buzz. We'll stick them on a bus somewhere if we can, and I'll be happy to show them around town.
Ray Boersma with two U's. Thank you very much, sir. It's great to meet you.
All right. Take care. Thanks a lot.
You bet. And now the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, Gary Chu, tells us about the brand new film called Born to be Wild. I sure hope it has something to do with Steppenwolf and this great rock tune from the 60s.
Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure.
You'd think with a film titled Born to be Wild, there'd be at least a few bars of the Steppenwolf song backing some of the action on the screen. But oh no, we get Mel Torme singing I'm Coming Home, Baby, and Harry Nilsson doing Let the Good Times Roll. There are even other songs as well that have no connection whatsoever to Hermann Hesse or Peter Fonda. What's the deal? Well, it's because Born to be Wild, the new IMAX 3D documentary, is about animals whose destiny is to exist in the wild. You know, like on a savanna in Kenya or a rainforest in Borneo. The animals in this case, or film, are orphaned elephants or orangutans who've lost their mothers to poachers and are given another chance at life by humans who care about them. Wow, what a concept! And talk about a short documentary film, just 40 minutes, that would help engender a sense of care, family, and belonging in human children. Wow, what another concept that is, too! Little kids seeing how humans, mostly women, rescue and care for little elephants and orangutans and rehabilitate them to the habitat in which they're meant to be in, but as babies, can't manage on their own. The mellifluous-voiced Morgan Freeman gives you the skinny on how dedicated people like primatologist Dr. Biruta Galdikas and champion of elephants Dame Daphne Sheldrick, with their assistants, do what they do so well for these displaced beasts. Yep, there just isn't any way to write a review about this movie without using the term heartwarming. Heartwarming is good, especially for young children. Not only that, there's an opportunity for ducking away from splashed water as the baby animals obstreperously bathe and drink together. Or you can try to catch the soccer ball that also magically comes toward you via the giant 3D IMAX screen that looms just beyond your nose, while very ginormous amplifiers somewhere behind the screen pump voice, music, and wild sound of the wild from humongous speakers into your ears. A lot of oohing and awing went on as I watched and listened. 40 minutes is a fine running time for the small guys and gals in an audience. And even nicer, the kids don't have to watch animal innards being consumed by their four-footed stalkers or being butchered by their two-legged predators who come round now and then to take target practice, you know, just for the sport of it all. I wonder if anyone who develops video curriculum for children has ever thought about running three nurturing nature documentaries like Born to be Wild for every single blood and guts blow-em-away home video game a kid might play in a day's time. 5 stars for being what's good for you is what this well-done documentary gets. It's written by Drew Feldman and directed by David Lickley. Bravissimo, gentlemen. And I do mean gentlemen. Get the bravos and the pans on new movies posted online and written by the guy with his voice at TulsaTVMemories.com or by entering their titles in the IMDb search engine at the International Movie Database. That's IMDb.com. I'm Gary Chu. Up, over, and down in the valley.
Oh, so the new Born to be Wild doesn't have anything to do with Steppenwolf. Never mind.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.